Warning, today's episode contains graphic descriptions of torture and murder. If you have a weak stomach, I suggest you stop the episode now. But with that being said, enjoy the episode. Hello, welcome to Refresh Reality. I'm your host, Anthony Nugget. Today, we will be talking about haunted houses. But when I say that, a lot of people think, oh, haunted houses, not that scary. But we'll be diving into pretty dark stuff today. So let's get into our first case, the Borden Murder House. In 1845, the Borden home was built with 8 bedrooms and was later on bought by Andrew Borden in the early 1870s. Located on 232nd Street in the city of Fall River, Massachusetts, the house still stands today as a bed and breakfast and somewhat of a tourist attraction. Lizzie Borden was born on July 19th of 1860 in Fall River to Andrew Borden and Sarah Anthony. Lizzie was able to grow up in a fairly wealthy household due to her father's wealthy family and his job. Growing up, Lizzie shared a close bond with her older sister Emma, but it was only in 1863 that her mother died. However, 3 years later, Lizzie's father would marry Abby Gray, or better known as Abby Borden. Lizzie and her stepmother didn't have the brightest relationship, usually only referring to her stepmom as Mrs. Borden. Aside from the family, the only other person living at the estate was the Borden's family maid, Bridget Sullivan, who the family referred to as Maggie. Now, with that being said, and you have all the background information, let's get into the actual crime scene. It was just like any other morning on August 4th of 1892. Andrew had left for his morning walk at 9 a.m, leaving the ladies of the house to do chore work. At around 9:30 a.m, Abby went upstairs to make the bed in the guest bedroom. According to forensic detail, Abby was facing her killer at the time of contact. She was first struck on the side of the head with a hatchet-like weapon, which split her head just above the ear. The impact caused her to turn and fall face first on the floor, causing bruises on her nose and forehead. If that hadn't killed her yet, her killer then struck her approximately 17 more times directly at the back of her head, permanently killing her. At around 10:30 a.m., Andrew returned from his walk. However, his key didn't work, and so he knocked on the door for someone to come and open it. When Maggie came to the door, she found it was jammed. Maggie then claimed she heard Lizzie laughing from upstairs. Now, when I was doing my research on this, that was a very unnerving detail because by this time, Abby was already dead and her body would have been visible to anyone on the second floor. Eventually, Andrew got inside and Lizzie helped him take his boots off so he could take a nap on the couch. Remember that detail. Lizzie then informed Maggie that there was a department store sale and permitted her to go, but at the time, Maggie didn't feel too well and went to lie down. At 11:10 a.m, Maggie heard Lizzie yell, "Maggie, come quick! Father's dead! Someone came in and killed him!" There, Andrew was, slumped over the sofa, struck 10 to about 11 times in the head by a hatchet-like weapon. His eyeball had been hit so hard that it had been split cleanly in half, suggesting he was killed in his sleep. This was one of America's bloodiest murders, and it's good to mention that Andrew's boots were still on him when the body was discovered, casting a lot of suspicion over Lizzie Borden since she claimed she had helped him take his boots off. Now, of course, I could go on and on for a while about this case because there's just so much detail that went into this that it caused nationwide attention. It even propped up one of the creepiest nursery rhymes I have ever heard. Here it is.
Thank you.
Now let's talk about the manifestation at the house. Lights would flicker on and off in front of the owners. The staff would hear footsteps and doors closing upstairs and when there was no one up there. Pretty typical haunted house stuff. However, shadow figures have also been seen roaming the halls of the house, and most importantly, the shadow figure of a woman in an apparition that looks like Lizzie has been seen down in the basement by not one person, but by every single staff member and owner. Whether this house is still housing the unrest spirits of the Borden family, or a hot spot for the supernatural, it's without doubt this home has a deep and dark history within it. Now, let's move on to an even darker house, the LaLaurie Manor in New Orleans. Before we get started, if there's any fans of the American Horror Story show, you would recognize the name Madame LaLaurie, and that's because it is based off the real-life Madame LaLaurie. Today, we'll be exploring her history. The year is 1832, and the LaLauries had just built their three-story structure house in the heart of New Orleans. Dr. Leonard Louis Nicholas LaLaurie and his wife Delphine LaLaurie had a higher standing in society at the time due to their wealth. Of course, during this time period, many people owned slaves who were mistreated and looked at more like animals and pets instead of humans. But there were still some laws that kept slave owners from going too far with their mistreatments. The LaLauries were well known for housing grand parties at their home, but after a while, many guests started to speculate that the LaLauries were mistreating their slaves. After seeing their slaves were kept in horrid conditions, even by standards of slave treatment at the time, people saw how most children and women were half-starved. This prompted an official investigation. A local attorney went to the mansion to investigate the allegations of mistreatments, but in the end, he found no wrongdoings. Despite these claims of mistreatment, Madame LaLaurie was well known to be extremely polite to black people in the public. Even at one point, she manumitted two of her own slaves. However, one account described Madame LaLaurie as becoming enraged when a 12-year-old slave girl named Leah accidentally hit a snag while combing LaLaurie's hair. LaLaurie then chased the girl around the room with a whip until the child leaped off the balcony to her death. Leah was buried behind the mansion grounds, and LaLaurie was finally found guilty of cruelly abusing her slaves. She was forced to forfeit her 9 remaining slaves. The slaves were scheduled to be sold at an auction, but unfortunately, LaLaurie was able to convince a relative to buy all the slaves and return them to her manor. But it was only on April 10th of 1834 that a fire broke out in the kitchen of the LaLaurie mansion. When the police and fire marshals arrived, they found a 70-year-old woman chained to the stove. This was the family cook. She later confessed that she started the fire as a suicide attempt because she was afraid Madame LaLaurie intended to take her to the torture room as punishment. The cook claimed that anyone brought upstairs would never return. This led to bystanders demanding the LaLaurie to let them in to this so-called torture room. When the LaLauries violently denied them entrance, a mob formed and rushed the manor. What would be found in this torture room would become one of America's most gruesome crime scenes. You have been warned. When first opening the door, the mob would see about a dozen naked slaves in there. Some were strapped to operating tables, a few were chained to the walls by their necks, others were crouched in cages made for little dogs. One woman had her stomach slit open and her intestines wrapped around her waist like a cruel corset. Another woman's mouth was shown shut after being filled with animal feces. A man had a hole drilled into his head with a stick inserted, presumably used to stir his brains. Most of these slaves were dead, but some were still hanging on to their lives. Some theorized that the LaLauries were practicing risky medical operations on their slaves, but with the conditions we've seen, it's fair to say the motives behind this weren't very medical, but instead purely sadistic. The mob eventually chased the LaLauries out of town. It is not known what their whereabouts were for the next 15 years, but it is confirmed that Delphine LaLaurie died in Paris on December 7th of 1849. And now, the manifestations. For almost 200 years, there has been reports of paranormal activity coming from this house. It shouldn't surprise many that many hauntings attributed to the poor slaves that the Lalori had tortured. The torture room is known to have moans and screams coming from within it, with no one inside. After the house was ransacked by the mob, it would later become an apartment building some years later. But in 1894, a tenant was brutally murdered in his room. Police found his belongings ransacked, but nothing of value was taken. Perhaps this murder wasn't a robbery, but had intentional motives. But one thing we should take into account was about a week before this tenant died, he had talked to his friends about a demon who wanted him dead as long as he lived in that apartment. And that is how he met his end. Is it possible an entity beyond our world killed him? That's really up to you to believe. After this, the manor would become a strictly all-girls African-American school in the mid to late 19th century. Within a short amount of time, the students would start reporting acts of physical assault. Little girls that were 6 to 8 years old ran up to their teachers, tears streaking down their faces, with their sleeves rolled up, showing that their forearms had been scratched and bruised, almost like a whip had hit them. When teachers asked who did this, the girls would answer, "That woman," claiming a phantom lady had hit them. Was this the spirit of Madame Lalori? Fun fact, famed actor Nicolas Cage actually bought the house at one point because he too was very interested in the paranormal. But after a while, he had to sell the house again due to money issues. It is safe to say, however, this mansion is filled with dark and decrepit history. Whether the spirits in this house are unrest or have moved on, the house still stands today as a dark landmark of New Orleans. Now let's take a break for our sponsors. Alright, welcome back. The next house we're going to talk about probably has the most mysterious crime scene of the bunch. We'll start with the night before the killings. The date is Sunday, June 9th, 1912 in Villisca, Iowa. Josiah and his wife Sarah Moore took their four children, 11-year-old Herman, 10-year-old Catherine, 7-year-old Boyd, and 5-year-old Paul to a children's church event. Accompanying the Moore family would be the Stillinger children, 12-year-old Leanne and 8-year-old Ina. The group would hang out until around 9:30 p.m. before they headed back to the Moore's house where they went to bed. Just around after midnight, the killer would enter the home carrying Joe's axe, which they found in the backyard. The murderer would bludgeon to death all 8 victims. At around 7:30 a.m., the Moore's elderly neighbor became concerned when the Moore's house was a little too quiet. She then called for Joe's brother, Ross, who would arrive at the house around 8 a.m. When he stepped into the house, he would discover two figures covered with a sheet in the back downstairs bedroom. He also saw blood on the bedstead. He then stepped away from the house to fetch the town's marshal, Hank. At 8:30 a.m., Hank would declare all 8 occupants dead. The crime scene houses 3 bizarre details. The first was a 4-pound slab of bacon leaning against the wall next to the partially cleaned murder weapon, which was an axe. The killer also searched the dress drawers for pieces of clothing to cover the mirrors and the glass in the entry doors. And finally, on the kitchen table was a plate of uneaten food and a bowl of bloody water. What did this all mean? Nobody really knows. All the victims were found in their beds with their heads covered in a bedcloth, and all their skulls were battered in around 20 to 30 times with the blunt end of an axe. The ceiling in the parents' bedroom and the children's room upstairs showed gouge marks apparently made by the upswing of the axe. The Moore Stillinger funeral would be held on June 12 of 1912, with thousands in attendance. The case was never solved and the killer was never identified, making it another cold case on this list. As far as we know, the manifestations at this house is fairly active. Footsteps, things moving, voices, apparitions, and just overall a bad vibe have been experienced at this house. A man named Pat stayed at the home in 2009 and was nonetheless happy with all the paranormal evidence he collected. This includes his flashlight flashing on and off after saying the names of the former victims. However, the most bizarre account of a haunting occurred on November 7th of 2014. A man named Robert Lorson, along with a team of paranormal investigators, came to the house in hopes of capturing something on recording. However, at one point, Robert strayed away from the group. He then suddenly stabbed himself in the northwest bedroom while the team was outside. Apparently, he stabbed himself around 12:45 a.m., which coincidentally was the same time the Moores and Stillingers were murdered. Robert has not spoken further about the experience due to respect towards the owners and the establishment. The house still stands today, stripped of plumbing and electricity to restore its full early 1900s feel. You can visit during the day for a house tour, which is about $10, and even book to stay there overnight, which is about $428. While the tragic backstory of the home has never been explained, it remains as a hot spot for tourists and ghost hunters alike. And now, the last house on our tour, the Sally House in Atchison, Kansas. The story goes that the Sally House was once a physician's office and home. One day, a mother came frantically carrying her child, 6-year-old Sally, who had collapsed from severe abdominal pain. The doctor diagnosed appendicitis and knew there was no time to delay action. Believing the appendix would soon rupture, the doctor began cutting into Sally before any anesthetics took effect. Sally screamed in agony for several minutes until it stopped, and there she laid, limp and pale. Her last memories of a man who she believed was torturing her. Aside from this story, there has been three other documented deaths at this home. The first would be Michael Finney, the builder of the house, who died only a year after building it in 1872. The second documented death would be of William True, Michael's son-in-law. While on vacation with his wife Agnes, he suffered a massive stroke. Believing he would recover in Atchison, she took him back. Michael would lay in bed unconscious for 3 days before dying. And the last documented death would be of Agnes Finney True in 1939. However, despite all this, the house would not gain attention until around 1993, when a couple, Tony and Deborah Pickman, moved into the house. At first, the couple's dog would seem to growl at nothing, especially near the upstairs nursery. But things started to take a much sinister turn. The husband, Tony, would suffer attacks that included bruises and scratches on the chest and back. However, the wife and baby was never harmed. Aside from the attacks, electronics and video equipment would either stop or completely drain of battery even after a full charge within the house. Objects were moved and thrown as weapons towards people. The operating area would become noticeably cold, and trained guide dogs would refuse to enter the nursery. The Sally House has been featured on paranormal shows like Ghost Adventures and has its own full-length documentary. Today, tourists can spend a night at the Sally House with the emphasis on restrictions, including no Ouija boards or seances, and no attempting to cleanse the house of spirits. Arguably the most haunted house in not just Kansas, but America. Alright, now it's time to refresh everything. So, with the Borden house, do I believe there's spirits in there? Yes, for sure, 100%. There's just so much evidence and investigations out there that just boggles my mind. The shadow figure of Lizzie Borden has been seen many times, and that's amazing to me. So yes, I do believe in that, and it is it's very shameful that all these murders did occur in all the houses. The LaLaurie Mansion, I'm kind of on the fence for this one because it is a historical place of just sadness and sorrow because so much pain came out of that place. Many spirits could still reside there. Me personally, I believe in ghosts and all that, but if we're talking from an evidence standpoint, there has not been much since the house. You can't really walk in it and take tours or anything because it is privately owned. There hasn't been many investigations on it, so again, I can't really speak my mind truly on this one just because there's just not enough on it. With the Villisca Axe Murder House, I would like to say that the crime scene was very, very interesting. The fact that there was a whole slab of bacon next to the murder weapon is very confusing. With everything that's been recorded from the Villiscas, I guess I can say I do also believe there's spirits in that house. The fact that Robert stabbed himself in the northwest bedroom around the same time the murders happened. He hasn't spoken out about that, so I kind of wish he would have, so I would have made more of an opinion. But for now, I guess I can say I do believe that there is something residing there. And with the Sally house, yes, definitely 100% ghost. That there's something in there. It attacks people, and it is not a peaceful spirit towards men. It is, however, very peaceful towards women and children. So whether this is the spirit of Sally or another person, it is, with all respect, that there is something in there. Hello everyone, thank you for listening to the episode. I think I worked very hard on this one, more than the others, for sure. I gained a giant boost of motivation suddenly out of nowhere, like a few days ago, and I decided to put this together. It has been a long time since the last episode, and that is because I did lose motivation. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Refresh Reality Podcast. Aside from that, I don't really know the future of this podcast holds. I definitely want to get out more episodes while I have this motivational boost. So, yeah. Until the next episode then. Thanks for listening.